Hello and welcome to the increasingly inaccurately named Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Pressure is mounting on Israel and Hamas to end the current round of fighting, which has left over 200 Palestinians and 12 Israelis dead. On Wednesday, President Biden urged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to seek significant de-escalation. In response, the Israeli leader thanked Biden for his support, but vowed to continue the operation until its objective is achieved. Moreover, the allegedly war-averse Prime Minister refused to rule out an Israeli return to the Gaza Strip 16 years after the disengagement. Joining me today to try and make sense of the fourth senseless war between Israel and Gaza in the past 12 years, I'm delighted to welcome back to the pod Haaretz's senior intelligence analyst, Yossi Melman. Thanks for coming in, Yossi. How have you been keeping?
Thank you, Simon. I'm well.
We're also joined today by Haaretz.com's tech editor, Omer Ben-Jacob. How are you, Omer?
I'm great, Simon. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you. Yossi, before we talk about how and when this conflict is going to end, can we talk about how it started? You wrote that it was the result of miscalculations by both sides. What happened?
Well, there was a series of incidents. Each of them are minor and I would say even almost insignificant. And each of it could have been dealt very easily. But because of negligence and maybe malice and bad intentions, they accumulated into a critical mass and eventually exploded. The first step was the cancellation by the Palestinian Authority with the backing of the Israeli government and the Israeli security services of the Palestinian elections out of fear that Hamas would win the elections. Hamas protested. Hamas blamed Israel for mingling, intervening behind the scenes in Palestinian affairs, of supporting the Palestinian Authority. Then it was during the Ramadan month, which is highly sensitive, emotional, and it has been known for Israel. Then came a police commissioner who was completely inexperienced. He wanted to show his determination and force, and he ordered to set barricades along the gates which are leading to the old city during the month on the path which was leading to the mosques on Temple Mount. And eventually all that resulted in activating tensions between young Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Israeli police. Then Hamas moved in order to change the equation, to be crowned as the guardians of Jerusalem and the mosques. And the Israeli government was very relaxed and relaxed and did very little. And then the war broke out.
So this all broke out 12 days ago. It's been building up for a few weeks before. And Netanyahu said yesterday that Operation Guardian of the Walls, as they've called it, isn't over. Israel will keep attacking Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza until its goals have been achieved. What exactly are those goals, Yossi? And what's left in the so-called target bank?
I don't think that Prime Minister Netanyahu knows what are the goals of the war. There are no goals for the war except to create as much damage as possible to Hamas military capabilities, the rockets, the tunnels, their workshops in which they manufacture the rockets, to kill as many Hamas leaders, commanders as possible. But there is no strategic goal. There is no diplomatic goal for the war, and it's just rolling and rolling and rolling, because it's more or less the same. It's a repetition of what happened in 2014. It only lasted 51 days. Now we are on the 12 days, and I believe that we see the light at the end of the tunnel. We see, so to speak, we see the end of these hostilities.
Will anything have changed? If the war ends today, and I call it a war, although that's probably
not
the most accurate description. If this all ends today, will Israel have achieved anything?
It depends if Israel and Hamas are seriously interested in negotiating a long-term solution. The solution is there. You just need to grab it. You just have to collect it. If you have determination and if you show leadership, you can have a solution, a long-term solution, peace along the Israeli-Gaza border, a reconstruction, rehabilitation economically, socially of Gaza, of the 2 million Palestinians who live there in poverty, with no drinking water, with very little electricity. And then also you have to be very creative in order to include in that deal, future deal, the prisoner swap. Mm. These are the elements of the deal. The question is whether Netanyahu is interested in it or not. And I think so far, when I say so far, in the last couple of years, all he wants is to manage the Palestinian conflict. He wants to weaken the Palestinian Authority without breaking the rules. And he wants to maintain the conflict with Hamas.
Is there anybody on the Israeli side? I mean, Netanyahu potentially is on his way out of Balfour Street after losing or not winning the last election. Is there anyone on the Israeli side who does have that determination and that leadership to finally end the terrible situation in Gaza?
No. I think Israeli leaders are behaved, subjected to what one can call the group thinking. They believe that power is the only solution. Now, the top leadership of Israel includes Netanyahu on one end, but also Benjamin Gantz, the defense minister, and a former chief of staff, Ashkenazi, who is a foreign minister. Have we heard what he is saying about the war? And then you have the military leadership, chief of staff, Lieutenant General Aviv Kochavi, the head of the Shin Bet, Nadav Argaman. All of them are in favor of more force and more killing, not for the sake of killing. They believe that Hamas would be deterred by damaging and destroying its military positions. But they don't see how to get out of the deadlock in order to pave the way for a diplomatic solution.
Mm. Yossi, I have a question for you about kind of the damage Israel has tried to do to Hamas as a military organization. One of the people killed in one of the attacks was Hamas's cyber chief. Do you know this guy, Jamaat Taha? Exactly. So, yeah, a lot of my sources also kind of laughed when I asked what kind of cyber operations Hamas had. And I was interested, is this part of a wider kind of attack on Hamas's infrastructure, or are we just, as Simon said, emptying the bank?
Omer, the tactical level, at the military level, the aims of the war were very clear: to destroy Hamas defensive lines underground, the tunnels, as we call them, 15, 20 kilometers, or Gaza downtown or Gaza metro. They built a very impressive, extensive network of tunnels and bunkers with electricity, with water, with shelters, with workshops. So that was partially achieved. It suffered a major blow to that installation site, which cost billions of dollars. I mean, digging and bringing cement and iron underground. That was one aim. The second aim was to kill, assassinate as many commanders of Hamas, including those who were responsible for manufacturing the rockets, the engineers and technicians, the experts in cyber warfare. Hamas has very small cyber capabilities. It is an inception, but it's growing. On the other hand, the rocket engineers are very good. Some of them studied abroad, including in the United States. They gained an expertise and were trained by Iranian and Hezbollah experts. They went out of Gaza and came back for study and learning. So, yes, the damage was extensive. On all the aims more or less were achieved. And that's why no one understands why the war is prolonged.
Mm. What about Hamas then? What does it hope to achieve? I read one analysis that claimed that Hamas's main achievement so far, perhaps its only achievement, has been to unite all the Palestinians between the river and the sea.
Well, it's more complex. Hamas' aim is to become the dominant force among the Palestinians and to replace the Palestinian Authority. That's why they initiated the war, because they wanted to break the old equation which existed between Israel and Hamas. And it talks about that equation was referring to hostilities and violence only between Hamas and Israel along the Gaza border. Mm. Hamas came out and said, we were going to extend it to East Jerusalem and to the West Bank. We are the guardians of the Palestinian people. So we are not just the rulers of Gaza. We are going to be, that's their strategic goal, to be the dominant force, or even the those who are calling the shots and the rulers of the West Bank. So in that sense, this is their strategic goal. At the tactical level, the more they prolong the war, that's their victory. That's their victory. And they have shown an impressive resilience by launching these rockets. They assembled a very extensive arsenal of 15,000 rockets, most of them all of them inaccurate, most of them in the small range, low range of 5 to 20 kilometers, but also longer range of up to 80 kilometers, those which are hitting Tel Aviv and central Israel. Mm. And they show creativity. Despite the siege, they managed to get these basic materials for manufacturing the rocket, the explosives, the iron, the tubes, the instruments that are needed to assemble them. So, yeah, they are improving from one battle to another. Mm.
Is that proof that Israel's blockade of Gaza is a failure? The fact that they've been able to get all of these construction materials, all of these rocket materials into the strip unabetted and with Qatari money that Israel has approved, of course.
Well, the bottom line is, yes, it's a failure. But even when the smuggling lanes were from Libya via Egypt to Sinai through the tunnels to Gaza, the other route was by the sea from Iran to Sudan, and from Sudan by land in convoys once again to Egypt, Sinai, Gaza. Israel managed to stop these together with the Egyptian intelligence and the Egyptian army, which worked together. These lanes were stopped, but Hamas, with their engineers and technicians and workforce, managed to be very creative and to produce locally the materials for the rocket. Some of it was still smuggled, but a lot of it was basically taken from local materials, including those materials, dual-use materials, chemicals, for example, which are supposedly, seemingly for agriculture or industry, and were diverted by Hamas to be used for military purpose. And more, I would say 50% of the money, which in Israel we called it ransom or bribery, which Israel agrees that Qatar would send to Gaza, is diverted, is taken, is confiscated, if you wish, by Hamas.
So at the time of recording, it's Thursday morning here in Israel. Hamas is saying that a ceasefire could be imminent within a day or two. What kind of pressure is the international community putting on Israel? Does the United States, which is currently involved, albeit from a distance, in renegotiating the Iranian nuclear deal, does the U.S. have any special leverage over Jerusalem right now?
I think we are close to a ceasefire because both sides are exhausted. Both sides can claim we achieved our goals. They can declare victory. Secondly, there is a growing pressure by the international community and especially the Biden administration. The fact that Biden is using a very soft language and in a way is supporting Israel, because one shouldn't forget that it was Hamas who initiated the war. It is Hamas who is launching rockets against civilians, Israelis, intentionally, unlike Israel, which is targeting a military force by also unwittingly civilians, innocent people are
unwittingly
killed.
But inevitably, perhaps.
Yes, yeah, inevitably, because it's a war. despite the surgical assaults and strikes by the Israeli Air Force. Still, civilians are killed, children and women, and in growing numbers. Mm. So there is a pressure from Biden on Netanyahu. Netanyahu seems to show that he doesn't understand hints, like he's ignoring what Biden is telling him. Look, they had three conversations within a week, the president and the prime minister. Mm. From Biden's inauguration to May, they spoke only twice. One was a kind of a courtesy call. So the pressure is mounting. I think there is a discontent among many Democrat congressmen and congresswomen and senators. And eventually, I think Israel will have to settle for a ceasefire. I hope that the ceasefire would result also a diplomatic solution. Otherwise, if it's an interim ceasefire for a day or two or a week, we will be back in square one, more of the same.
And back here in the studio in 6 months, discussing the fifth Gaza war in 12 years. Omel, you mentioned Hamas's cyber chief who's just been assassinated. And I know you've been keeping an eye on how this conflict is being waged on social media. Yeah. First of all, I have to say rather you than me. I mean, even the Mama Hive Facebook group is kicking out mums who express support for Israel.
Yeah, for
is,
sure.
Is that representative of what's going on these platforms, Omel?
So I'd almost recontextualize it in a kind of wider frame. I think that as kind of the first big geopolitical event after Corona, and the world kind of rediscovering Israel and the conflict, what we're seeing is what we used to perhaps call asbara, or what would maybe even call information warfare.
Mm-hmm. Public diplomacy.
Exactly.
Is
so
the,
it's
the preferred phrase.
Public diplomacy when it's when you do it, and it's propaganda when the enemy does it. Yeah. So I think all these things we're seeing them now play out in a very kind of wide scale, holistic scale, and now we kind of post Trump we have terminology to address this. We used to call it asbara, but we can just call it disinformation. Mm. And I think that we have a massive kind of disinformation war going on from both sides. And one aspect of it is exactly that, this kind of radical or very quick politicization of every small social media group. And I think you're right, that is representative of what you experience. And I think it's happening in other places as well. So across the board, we're seeing, for example, on social media revealed this week that there was a maybe cyber or Hamas operation of fake accounts just trying to bump people out. Oh, and I live in Israel and it's so terrible here. The army can't handle it. I want to leave. We should all leave Israel. So you see these kind of small things, but it's also happening at a wider scale as well, where we see information and disinformation being weaponized by both sides. So early on in the kind of operation, we had Israel dupe or play around with the international media saying the ground operation has begun while it didn't actually begin. And on the Palestinian side, you see these kind of what I call jokingly the infographic intifada, these very simplistic kind of rundowns of the conflict. And within Israeli society, and I think this is perhaps the scariest, we're seeing tons of disinformation along the lines of kind of Jewish versus Arab and Arab versus Jewish incitement. And together that creates a very dangerous and volatile information ecosystem.
I mean, it was reported at the time that social media and in particular TikTok videos sparked and fanned Jewish Arab violence. What role did TikTok play in that?
Okay, so we're seeing a lot on TikTok videos, mostly of actual young Palestinians or Arabs documenting kind of violent attacks or documenting instances of protest. And you are seeing this kind of new arena of viral, somewhere between snuff and pro-Palestinian kind of movies from East Jerusalem and to a lesser extent from Gaza. And I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, we finished kind of the Trump era thinking that, you know, we kind of nailed social media and we kind of know how to manage this stuff. And then you do have these new arenas. So TikTok is a very good example of that. We're not, the disinformation or the anti-violent stuff that we did know how to put into place in the past doesn't really work yet on TikTok. Another arena very similar to this is Clubhouse. So I couldn't confirm this, but there were reports that Khaled Mashal had hosted a room in Clubhouse in Arabic talking freely. And I think if you think about it in the kind of wider scheme, like, you know, no one would put Khaled Mashal on TV today in that same way and give him an open mic in a sense. So I think we're seeing these new arenas enter the spaces that we thought that we kind of, you know, managed to deal with already with Facebook fake news and so on and so forth.
Mm. The IDF is also engaged in meme wars, right?
Oh, for sure.
As John Oliver suggested on his show earlier this week, it might not be such a good idea to make a meme of a war crime.
Yeah.
Are the social media companies taking any action against this disinformation? Who even decides what's disinformation and what's propaganda and what's
so that's a really
advocacy?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. Within Facebook, I know this from kind of my sources and other reporting that's been out, that there is actually a war going on within Facebook and within the kind of content moderation debate about how to manage it. Because Israel geographically needs to be part of MENA, that's North Africa, mm-hmm. but the Israeli senior Facebook executives do not want people from Egypt and Tunis deciding what is hate speech for them, and therefore we are now currently through some backdoor looped into Europe. And the essence of this debate, of course, is anti-Zionism equating or non-equating anti-Semitism. And there's claims that it's very hard to check because Facebook is closed, that posts involving the word Zionist are now being taken down as hate speech because Israel has the upper, like, so if you use Zionist in a negative term, you know, the Zionists are attacking Gaza, then that can now be labeled hate speech. And there have been, for example, yesterday there was a big letter of Jewish Google workers in the US who wrote that they don't want Google to, you know, to silence and so on and so forth and stand with Palestine. And one of the claims they made there was exactly that Google as a search engine has a role in stifling or not stifling free speech exactly in this context of what can be said against Israel and critically, and when does that become anti-Semitism or hate speech? And there is a very kind of...
If Israelis are saying we are proud Zionists to launch a war against Hamas, then it's anti-Semitism?
No, I think it's not anti-Semitism in any way, but I think the point is that what you're saying is absolutely right, that it's these content debates, there's something very kind of, in a sense, I would almost say stupid about them. You know, this attempt to kind of boil down free speech to single keywords, and I think that once again, we're seeing, and this was Simon's question, how little or how actually uninvested these social media networks are in actually solving this. Like, it's such an unintelligent solution to a problem that I feel that we've been talking about close to 10 years at this point. It's not really new anymore. And I think that, you know, like, you look at things like live videos. So live videos are very hard to police. Like, if someone is live streaming a protest, that's in a sense, can incite violence. It's an entire ecosystem. And for me, the common denominator, and I think John Oliver was in a sense right about this, about Israel, I think he was wrong in the wider context, is that both sides are doing this. And it doesn't really matter. There is a difference between the IDF lying to international media and the state of Israel, you know, doing a meme about war crimes and some, you know, very popular Instagram page like Diet Prada or Muslim Girl posting some, you know, borderline anti-Semitic infographic. But they all follow the same logic, which is that the truth doesn't matter and the facts can be subjugated for whatever goal we need. And I think that is dangerous. I think we know that's dangerous at this point. But seeing it repeat itself at such a volume is, to me, upsetting.
Yossi, does the Israeli intelligence community take these kind of things seriously, or are they stuck in the boomer mentality that what happens on social media doesn't really have any impact?
No, the IDF and the Israeli intelligence, the Shin Bet and even the Mossad, which is less involved in this war, are taking very seriously the psychological warfare, as they call it, or information warfare, or disinformation warfare, and they are heavily involved in it. They have departments which are dealing with what kind of messages to send, what would be the effect of the messages on the other side, and even what would, which I think is wrong, even what effect it would be on the Israeli morale or the Israeli population. That's not the role of the IDF. We are still a democracy. Therefore, if they want to launch tools to spread rumors in among the Palestinians or against the enemy, that's fine. I mean, it's part of the warfare effort. But when they start to also to judge and value what would be the effect on Israel, then the military is suddenly involved in civic society and decisions which has to be made by the government. But they are taking it very seriously. They have very strong cyber capabilities, defensive and offensive. In a way, I'm interested to hear from Omer, how do you assess the Hamas cyber capabilities? Because in the past, they were, you know, the Israeli military discovered, uncovered efforts by Hamas to recruit soldiers with fake profiles
on Tinder
and so on.
Anecdotally, I'll just remind people that in 2014, during the previous Gaza conflict, Hamas managed to send out text messages, fake text messages, to Israeli cell phones, as if they were coming from Haaretz, reporting on a strike on the Haifa Bay area.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
they if 7 years ago they had that kind of capability, have they progressed since then?
That's a great question. I think context is important. Compared to Israel, it's a joke. Obviously, we all understand this. It's beyond a joke. It's non-comparable. I think Hamas is, like in other examples, are very good at leveraging their kind of disadvantage to their advantage. So, for example, I think a lot of the social media stuff happening today is, in a sense, helping them. I don't know, it's coordinated by them. The real Hamas cyber operations are very, very limited. So, for example, you look at this kind of recent round of fake accounts. You know, it's 2021. Bots don't really, you know, no Israeli will open Twitter and see, you know, the IDF is not handling it, I'm so depressed, and then decide to leave Israel. You know what I mean? But I think we are seeing here and there small instances of things that do or can actually, you know, make an effect. And I think things like what Simon are talking about are true. So-called phishing attempts or attempts to kind of dupe more specific types of Israelis. That is a real threat. And again, I also know that there is on social media an attempt by the Israeli officials to actually take down content. So I got a statement yesterday from the Justice Ministry. I think there's over 1,000 posts that they have requested be removed. And I'm guessing that the logic is that there is in their mind some threat. So at that level, again, at the holistic level, there is some dent, but it's not, you know. Compared to what Israel can do, it's small fries.
And what it does.
Exactly, yes, exactly what it does.
Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time. We didn't even have time to discuss the war of words between Gal Gadot and Mia Khalifa, I'm afraid. We'll have to leave that for another episode. Yossi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Omer, it's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again soon with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.